Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, an Oval Office address, a peace talks push, stubborn unemployment, and a hurricane bearing down this week as we say goodbye to August. On Tuesday, President Obama addressed the nation and declared Operation Iraqi Freedom finished.
I am announcing that the American combat mission in Iraq has ended.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, with Israeli and Palestinian leaders at her side, welcomed new Mideast peace talks and said the United States cannot make them work.
We cannot and we will not impose a solution. Only you can make the decisions necessary to reach an agreement and secure a peaceful future.
And on the Atlantic coast, residents of North Carolina's Outer Banks braced for Hurricane Earl.
God is truly in control of this.
You never know what's going to happen.
If you leave and something bad did happen, you're not going to be able to get back.
This hour on Point, it's our weekly news roundtable with David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, Margaret Tolliv, White House correspondent for the McClatchy newspapers, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Unemployment's up again. What should we do? Middle East peace talks are back on. Are you holding your breath? And what's your end of summer thought for the nation? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. North Carolina's governor is saying maybe the hit from Earl won't be as bad as feared. Margaret Tolliv, have you brought the cat in there in Washington?
Well, I've canceled all plans to head east for the weekend.
All right. Hunkered down and bunkered down, and we'll see how it all turns out. We'll get to the economy, big issues there, and looking ahead as well. But Mideast peace talks back on some kind of rails this week. I'm sure everybody has been watching that. Let's listen to a little bit. This is from just yesterday. As things got off, I don't know at what speed again here, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, here he is talking directly to his Palestinian counterpart, Mahmoud Abbas, on the little stage set up in Washington.
President Abbas, you are my partner in peace. And it is up to us, with the help of our friends, to conclude the agonizing conflict between our peoples and to afford them a new beginning.
President Abbas, you are my partner in peace. We'll see. Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, speaking through a translator here, said all issues must be on the table in the new peace negotiations.
We will spare no effort and will work diligently and tirelessly to ensure that these negotiations achieve their goals and objectives in dealing with all of the issues. Jerusalem, refugees, settlements, borders, security, water, as well as the release of all our prisoners.
David Sanger, what is going on here? Why is the White House pushing this right now? Everybody would like peace. Peace would be great. Peace talks are maybe overdue. Why right now?
Well, as always with Mideast issues, everything's about timing and everything's about how issues interlock. And in this case, both are at play. I think many in the White House came to the conclusion that they basically blew it the first year. You know, remember that when President Obama first came to office, he announced that there had to be a freeze of all settlements to get talks going. And then he backed away from that last September and basically allowed some settlements to go forward or no longer made it a precondition. The Israelis then later announced some settlements. They haven't actually built much, but they've been talking about it a lot. And that ended up costing them almost another year in getting direct talks rolling. But right now, the president believes that a couple of things have come together. Iran, for the first time, is on the run a little bit because of sanctions. By the pullout in Iraq, or at least the pullout of combat troops, the president can make a convincing case to the Arab world that he's not, the United States is not really interested in occupying Iraq, and that we're on the pathway to a full pullout at the end of next year. And finally, you've got two political leaders who seem to be at the height of their powers right now. Prime Minister Abbas has actually shown that he's got a workable government going, even though the Palestinians themselves are very divided between his government, which is willing to negotiate, and of course Fatah, which is not and still involved in an armed opposition to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And in Prime Minister Netanyahu, he's got the hawk who President Obama hopes is ready to go do what Nixon goes to China.
Jack Beatty, do you see partners in peace here, Netanyahu's phrase we just heard there in the tape, in Washington this week?
Well, you know, the factors that David was just outlining, and I think the metaphor used in his piece yesterday was a virtuous cycle of events, one thing feeding the other favorably. Rahm Emanuel was quoted as saying, you know, success begets success. Equally, one could imagine a vicious cycle. One of those issues, Iran, Iraq, the Middle East, negatively affecting the other, and the cycle going in the other direction. You know, I'm wondering about, and I wonder if David could speak to this, what's going to happen in a couple of weeks when this settlement moratorium is over. I mean, Mr. Abbas has said, If they don't continue the moratorium, if the Israelis don't, the talks are over before they've begun. Is there some way they can fudge that, David? Are they thinking about that?
End of September, that's off. What do you say, David?
Well, you know, Jack's exactly right. And what I pointed out in this column was that the mistake that President Clinton made more than a decade ago was that while they thought they had a virtuous cycle at that time, in fact, what happened was that certain individual elements got unplugged, and as that happened, so did everything else fell apart as well. And that could certainly happen here. In the case of the settlements, that's going to be the first hurdle to pass, and the U.S. is trying to come up with a way to fudge this. And my guess is, and this is pure guesswork, that what they're trying to do at this point is get the Israelis to agree that there'll be no actual activity on the ground, even if the Israeli statement is somewhat well short of continuing the moratorium, and hoping that they can persuade Prime Minister Abbas that as long as there is no new settlement activity happening during the talks or anything other than the most minor natural growth, then he can go ahead. But you're absolutely right. That could blow this up the first time, and it will be a real sign of how much negotiating room each of these leaders have. Remember, for Prime Minister Netanyahu, most of his party is well to the right of him on this issue, and he's considered himself a considerable hawk. So he may not have a lot of room here without splitting apart the coalition that has kept him in power.
Margaret Tala, the talks move to Egypt in a couple of weeks. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will be there. George Mitchell will be there, the Middle East envoy. But everybody's been very clear. We heard Hillary Clinton say so. President Obama said the same thing, that, you know, the United States cannot do this. What's the U.S. stick or leverage this time, if any, Margaret?
Well, Iran is certainly a factor in how the U.S. views this, how Israel views this, and the sort of grander geopolitical game, you know. But I think ultimately the U.S. doesn't actually have that much leverage other than the spotlight. I mean, I really think that that's what it boils down to. And I think, look, there's no harm in trying, right? I mean, nobody would be against peace in the Middle East. This is something that President Obama promised he was going to pursue. And to the extent that he wants to be seen in the world stage in terms of engaging in politics in this region, I think, okay, Iraq, Afghanistan, the latest domestic kerfuffle over the mosque project near Ground Zero, this is a noble stance, a noble place for him to position himself. And I think they'd like to see what they can get done. But, you know, sometimes when you're covering something, you have to sort of just take a measure of the general mood, the overall mood that surrounds something. And right now, I would say that the overall mood does not have particularly high expectations for them to meet their goal of a plan to be locked down within a year. I do think there's some room for negotiation on that September the 26th date. And I think that
this is the moratorium ending on
settlement building in the West Bank. And I do think that the White House's posture at this point is to presume that both leaders' opening statements were negotiating positions and not lines total lines in the sand. But this is a really tough road ahead.
Here's George Mitchell yesterday talking about the next phases of negotiation.
The parties agreed that in their actions and statements, they will work to create an atmosphere of trust that will be conducive to reaching a final agreement.
Atmosphere of trust is the phrase, but of course, four Israelis killed this week in Hamas attacks, and those the settlement building moratorium due to expire late in September. David Sanger, you've got people looking at this and saying, you know, this is maybe a noble stance, but this looks kind of like trying to pull the spotlight away from the U.S. economy. We see the unemployment numbers again today, up from 9.5 to 9.6. Not as bad as thought, but is this a dodge?
I don't think it's a dodge, and we should discuss the economy in a moment.
Yeah.
But
mm-hmm.
Remember what the critique was during the Bush administration, that President Bush was fundamentally uninterested in solving this problem, and what message that sent out to the Arab world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that any American president has to demonstrate that they can solve this problem. This problem's been with us since the recognition of Israel in the Truman administration, and it's not going to go away, you know, immediately. But I think that President Obama has calculated, and I think rightly so, that he's got to demonstrate to the rest of the world that he is making every good faith effort to solve this, and that unless you're showing that, then it doesn't appear that you're serious in the region. And that was what President Bush ran into. You asked before about leverage. There is one piece of leverage, and you got at it before when you were discussing Iran. Prime Minister Netanyahu may well be calculating that if he makes a good faith effort here, he can come to the president a year from now and say, look, I tried on your number one agenda item.
You try on mine. David Sanger, hold the thought. Margaret Tolliff, Jack Beatty, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking today about a week in the news, looking at the headlines here. The president speaks on war and the economy, a new push on Mideast peace, another oil rig up in flames in the Gulf of Mexico, and all eyes on Hurricane Earl. David Sanger joins us, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, with us today from Weston, Vermont. Sounds nice. Margaret Tolliff is here from Washington. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. There's more on the Iran front, Iraq in the president's speech, Afghanistan this week, but I want to get to the economy if we can. Christina Romer, outgoing White House economic advisor, made a farewell address this week at the National Press Club in Washington. She defended the president's stimulus policies, but conceded that the Obama administration had not fully anticipated the depth of the recession.
Our estimates of the impact of the Recovery Act have proven to be quite accurate. But we, like virtually every other forecaster, failed to anticipate just how violent the recession would be in the absence of policy and the degree to which the usual relationship between GDP and unemployment would break down.
Relationship between GDP and employment breaking down. Terry in Brewstertown, Tennessee. Terry, you're on. Hi.
Good day, Tom. How much more do we need to know that giving money to the rich people and giving them tax breaks is not going to create jobs or improve the economy? And how much more deregulation do we need to show how dangerous it is?
Terry, your line's rough, but we got the thought. Margaret Tolliff, there's a lot of talk this week about some kind of new package tantamount to stimulus, but maybe indeed just as Terry's objecting to, but aimed at business and cutting business taxes. What's on the docket, Margaret?
Right. Well, everybody's waiting to see precisely what it'll be. The broad expectation is we'll start to see at least some of it next week in connection with the Labor Day holiday. And exactly the question is, the White House is insisting this is not going to be another $787 or $862 billion stimulus package. But, you know, could it be a couple hundred billion dollars? How would they cut it up? How would they make it palatable so that Republicans would have to seriously consider voting for it or at least look weird if they blocked it? You know, these are all the questions. And I understand Terry's concerns, but on the other hand, businesses do hire people. That's the rationale. So this is a slightly separate question from the other one of extending the middle class tax cuts and whether to lump the very high earners in with that extension. And that's something we'll see evolve, I think, you know, slightly later, slightly down the road. But among the variables that they're looking at, probably the possibility of some kind of a payroll tax holiday. trying to get some R&D credits unstuck that are stuck in the Senate, and of course the small business bill that the president talked about earlier in the week.
Payroll tax holiday, what exactly does that mean, Margaret?
The devil's in the details, right? But, I mean, it would, to some extent, it speaks for itself, right?
Employers would not have to pay payroll taxes on their employees for some period, or have cuts
that's
in
right.
Those?
But would it be passed on to... would it be passed on to workers? Would it just be for the employers? How would it be different than having a payroll tax incentive for adding new jobs? You know, how broadly would this apply? I mean, these are all the details that we're waiting to see.
David Sanger, how do you read what's going on in the White House and beyond? Of course, Ben Bernanke is integral to all this. But they're looking at this economy, unemployment back up to 9.6 in the numbers just out this morning, and they've got to be watching November 2nd, midterms day, and wondering, is there anything they can do in this narrow window? What are their options here, David?
You know, there's almost no economic step that you could take right now that would produce results between now and November 6th. I mean, just the levers don't work that fast, right? Yeah. But there are things you can do to indicate that they are on the way toward that. The payroll tax one would be an early example, because the thinking is that that would lead to hiring. And, you know, that's the key element here is both is private sector hiring, because what we've seen happen now is that the public sector has begun laying people off, particularly at the state level. They're certainly not hiring. The stimulus money for federal hiring, as we've all discussed before, is beginning to peter out, although if you've been driving around New England this summer, as I have some, it does seem like every 3 miles you come to another piece of road work that is funded by some part of the stimulus package.
Be happy while it's there, I guess.
That's right, but it won't last for long. And then the biggest problem they have is that in order just to keep the unemployment rate where it is, they need to be producing a few hundred thousand jobs every month. And what we saw in this morning's report was the private sector created about 67,000 jobs, but in the public sector it's flat or going down, shrinking to some degree. And so that is simply not enough to keep things the way they need to be just to hold this unacceptable unemployment rate. And that's a real hole for the president. And when you talk to most economists, they don't see a way out of that between now and, say, the middle of next year.
That's a long time in political terms. Jack, the president was out earlier this week before his Oval Office speech talking about the Republicans, you know, throwing down roadblocks. Paul Krugman this morning in David Sanger's paper, The Times is saying, go on, you know, push for something big. GOP will be against it no matter what you propose, so you might as well go big. How do you see the president's options now on the economy, Jack?
Well, I think the Krugman counsel is essentially to put politics first. I mean, David says rightly, policy can't yield any measurable results, so why not do politics? Politics would mean essentially drawing the line with the Republicans, sending up stimulus bills that would put people to work, having the Republicans filibuster them, sending up packages that they would turn down and just have them show them as roadblocks. I mean, Harry Truman did that with the Republicans. Of course, he didn't need even to encourage them in 1948, and ran on that.
But Jack, many Republicans will then say, and a lot of Americans are nodding in agreement these days, but that drives up the deficit. They can position themselves as champions, not roadblockers.
Well, difficult to do when they're defending the entire Bush tax cut, when they want that all to go forward, including the tax cuts for the wealthiest. Hard to argue that that's what $600 billion over 10 years for the richest Americans. Hard to argue that that's consistent with deficit reduction, and that's the other, I think, handle the Democrats have. They really should. Again, we're just talking politics here. Mm. But it seems to me the good seed is to say to the Republicans, okay, we're going to give you a choice. It's going to be tax cuts for the middle class, not for the wealthy, or nothing. And if the Republicans then block tax cuts for the middle class, well, then Obama can say, look at these people. They won't even allow you to have a tax cut.
Let's go to Bob in Madison, Wisconsin. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My point is that there is no, there will be no centralized solution to this problem with the economy. that in fact it was over centralization that brought this on, that plus corruption. And there's just corruption is pervasive throughout our culture.
What over centralization are you looking at, Bob?
Everywhere, in all aspects of the economy and the culture. I've been writing about this for quite a few years. Going back 20 years ago, I was advocating regionalism and economic and cultural decentralization.
So, and business decentralization? So forget Washington leading a recovery, sort of toss it back to every, what, burg and hamlet and town to lift themselves?
Well, it's got to be through coalitions, through villages and towns and cities, creating economic partnerships. And we have to have a decentralized banking system once again. I realize it has the possibility of leading to confusion if you had a multitude, say, of scripts. But it's just not going to happen through any plan or centralized plan coming out of Washington.
Get it out of Washington, you say, Bob, and we've got that. Margaret Taleb, you hear what Bob's saying, his sort of lack of confidence in Washington to lead this. On the other hand, I mean, the sort of orthodox economic view would be, you know, a deep economic troubled time is when you need centralized push. We're reading today about China investing big in some of its big firms and getting them back up on the rails, the government playing a big role there, and it's got 9-point-something% growth. We've got 1-point-something% growth, Margaret.
I'll tell you what I think is interesting about what Bob said is that I think it is a real connecting factor across the country among many of the voters who are intrigued or completely support the Tea Party movement this year. And I do think that you see an anti-Washington, anti-centralization kind of instinct playing mm-hmm. out and boosting mm-hmm. some of those efforts. And I think, you know, we know that's had a big impact in many primaries. What we don't know yet is precisely how it will factor in the general election.
Let's go to Amherst, Massachusetts, and Teresa. Teresa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just wondering what the panel thought about the possibility that previous policies or impending possible policies are slowing down the recovery. I mean, we have a huge health care plan that a lot of employers are waiting to see what the repercussions of that will be. Plus, we have impending possible what some people are calling tax, cap and tax, or, you know, cap trade, whatever policies that could, you know, penalize environmental issues. So I'm just wondering, you know, what about those aspects?
I'm not sure, Teresa, you're saying have we hurt the economy already by government policy? David Sanger, a lot of people look back and say, well, maybe, but it's, you know, a lot of this was born out of policies from Washington, but it got all mixed up with Wall Street on a tear before the meltdown came, and nobody knows where to point the finger now.
Well, I think what Teresa may be referring to is the economic impact of uncertainty. And she certainly has a point when it comes to tax policy. I mean, we've known for 10 years that the Bush tax cuts were going to expire. And the thinking was that, you know, by year 8 or 9, Congress taking this responsibly and recognizing that a deadline was coming up would go deal with it, and people would know what tax environment they're walking into. Well, of course, that didn't happen, and now we've got 3 months left to solve the problem, and we're going to end up doing it in a hurry. And you know what happens when you usually do things in a hurry. On the question of the health care bill and its potential impact, I'm not certain that that is causing as much hesitance on the part of businesses, including to hire people, in part because they are not certain at all that that's going to lead to higher costs for many of the companies that already provide health care. One last point goes back to your mm-hmm. previous caller, which has to do with putting together these, you know, regional economic groups and all that. Sounds good, feels good. But let's remember, we're in a global economy where the big growth is going to come out of exports to that part of the world that's consuming a lot more at a lot higher rates. And doing that regionally is not really usually the most effective way to do it.
Hard to deal with China, hard enough, I suppose, with the full weight of the United States in those negotiations. Regionally could be tough. But you can feel that impulse there to kind of break out of whatever we're in and do things differently. David, in Charlotte's...
You've seen that at many moments in American history where there's this idea of let's go back to, you know, sort of an agrarian, simpler economy. Mm. And, you know, it ain't going to happen. You just have to recognize
the ship has sailed.
That's not the economy we're in.
Many ships sailing out there. Charlottesville, Virginia. David, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. People talk about this whole age of peak oil. What if we're entering a period of peak everything, where capitalist markets and colonialization of the world's resources just isn't going to fly anymore? We just don't have access to those cheap resources anymore that sustain capitalism.
But yet you've got people out there who are, you know, going hand over fist. Brazil and China, India in its own way. I mean, Jack, it's interesting in the calls here, you can hear people really grappling with where we are in the scheme of things. You know, month after month without people having jobs starts to turn minds in many directions here, kind of erase the blackboard and start again impulse.
And a good one, and if some way to frame that in policy could be found, you know, I think our caller Bob was trying to put his finger on something that I think is valuable, namely that a lot of good things can come out of the states, that the states, what did Justice Brandeis call them, laboratories of democracy, that the policies of tomorrow, witness Massachusetts with its health care program, was really prelusive of the Obama plan. That's the way I think innovation does happen in our system. States try something. I think many states tried variants of this race to the top, which is the education department's big initiative, and now the education department is doing it. So I think there's a lot of sort of experimentalism that can go on the state and regional level that's valuable. What I'm worried about, and today's jobs report really frames it for me, is what Keynes was frightened about in the 30s. That is, the economy can reach equilibrium at high unemployment. In other words, you can go there and just stay there. That can become the new normal. And this kind of fudge report, not as bad as it could have been, not as good as it could have been, gives the Federal Reserve more excuse not to do anything. Now the question is, what could they do? Well, the minutes of the last meeting showed a caucus there, a group of governors of the Fed, who still think inflation is a big problem or could be. That's yesterday's thinking. I'm partial to what Ben Bernanke talked about years ago in a lecture, which is the way the New Deal dealt with this. They made a commitment, the Roosevelt Treasury, we're going to keep inflation at this number. And essentially they said, we're going to reflate the economy. Our commitment is to keep it there. If this Fed did that, and we're practically zero inflation now, that would all by itself just buoy a certain kind of confidence, and the increased cash in the economy would lubricate it. I think that's the kind of step they need to take. I'm afraid today's fudge message gives them an excuse not to take it.
Of course, everybody may be tempted to inflate the way out of the deficit at some point. Here's President Obama this morning responding to those unemployment numbers ticking up from 9.5 to 9.6%.
The key point I'm making right now is that the economy is moving in a positive direction. Jobs are being created. They're just not being created as fast as they need to, given the big hole that we experienced. And we're going to have to continue to work with Republicans and Democrats to come up with ideas that can further accelerate that job growth. I'm confident that we can do that.
He's confident he can work with Republicans on the economy. Margaret Tulloch, do you see reason for that confidence?
Well, what's he going to say? I give up. It's time to go home. Forget it.
No, but working with Republicans has not really been a real productive vein for this administration so far.
I know, but he's the president of the United States, and people are in a crisis of confidence as well as an actual crisis. And I think he's trying to put his best foot forward and trying to act like a grown up. And I don't see what options he has really.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, in a bizarre incident, Discovery Channel employees were held hostage by a gunman unhappy with the cable channel's programming. The three hostages survived. Police killed the gunman.
We was really scared. We're panicking, nervous, all of those feelings because we heard he had explosives, so we really were scared.
Another oil rig up in flames in the Gulf of Mexico. 13 crew members were left bobbing at sea. Here's Dan Shaw, captain of the ship that rescued them.
Well, you just said that there was an explosion and there was fire, and it happened very quick. Apparently, they didn't even have time to get into a life raft or floats of any kind.
And the Emmys had their night. Host Jimmy Fallon, Tina Fey, and more fooled around with the cast of Glee, then belted out some Springsteen.
Hey, Tina, come join our Glee Club.
Me? Really? You can't sing and dance, right? Not as good as you guys. Perfect. Will you roll with me out on the wire?
Because baby, I'm just a scared lonely rider, but I gotta know how.
We're looking at a week in the news. The president speaks on war and the economy, a new push for Mideast peace, another oil rig up in flames. Hurricane Earl has everybody's attention today. David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, joins us. Margaret Tolliv, White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, is here. And our own Jack Beatty, the president in the Oval Office, talking to the nation this week about the end of Operation Iraqi Freedom. He said the U.S. would leave a force of 50,000 troops to help in the coming months.
A transitional force of U.S. troops will remain in Iraq with a different mission, advising and assisting Iraq's security forces, supporting Iraqi troops in targeted counterterrorism missions, and protecting our civilians.
Margaret Tolliv, you're right on the White House there. The president had a kind of a dance to do between the Iraq news and the economy. What was he getting at most importantly the other night?
Boy, I'm not sure he knew what he was getting at most importantly. That speech was so filled with mixed messages. It's the end of the combat mission of this war that has absolutely defined the U.S.'s view in the rest of the world for the last, 7 years. It needed to be marked. But the timing of it, 2 months before an election, necessitates him trying to pivot on the economy. So the economy is really his central mission. But, I thought his central mission was national security. And now his other central mission is Afghanistan. It was a lot of plate spinning at the same time and very hard to take away one overriding message out of it, I thought.
And then trying to nod to George W. Bush, who started the war that Senator Obama had so fiercely opposed as dumb in a speech after the president's speech.
Yeah, a minimal nod, wouldn't you say?
Quite minimal nod, but here's John Boehner responding to that, saying that it was now clear that the Bush surge ultimately worked.
We mark progress. And I want to thank President Obama for setting aside his past political rhetoric and recognizing the importance of the surge and the diplomatic agreement signed by President Bush and Prime Minister Maliki.
$1 trillion and counting on just that war. David Sanger, we could use that in a lot of other areas right now. How do you see the narrative of this whole big chapter of the Iraq War moving toward the history books, David? We still got a lot of troops there, but, there's John Boehner saying, give credit to George Bush. Senator Barack Obama was harshly critical of exactly the same war that Boehner wants credit for.
Well, I think that's right. And, the Republican refrain all week, and it has some credibility to it, is that Barack Obama got elected as the man who opposed the Iraq War. And President Obama would say in response, rightly, that he promised to get the U.S. out, and he has moved 100,000 troops out. And, in fact, the Bush deadline of 2011 didn't include this combat troops out by the summer of 2010. So both of them can claim some element there. But if you back up a bit, I think that, as Margaret pointed out, the speech itself had a lot of mixed messages. And I think that's for a couple of reasons. The first is that President Obama, in his speech in December about sending the surge into Afghanistan, made a version of the same argument that we heard him make the other night, which is, we can't afford endless war. And therefore, we can't afford to stay in Iraq, and as he said in December, we can't afford to stay endlessly in Afghanistan. The problem with that is that it collides with the message of we're not abandoning these societies,
right.
We're leaving on a conditions-based scenario. So what happens in Afghanistan, for example, if, in fact, the Afghan army isn't ready to go pick up the slack as our troops leave? What happens in Iraq if Iraq devolves again into chaos? And that's a very difficult issue for the president because it could get you into a position of an endless presence, or at least a lengthy presence, and one that nobody in the United States seems to want to pay for anymore.
Jack Beatty, I thought the president looked awfully uncomfortable as he gave this speech on an August night in the Oval Office.
Yes, I agree. And he very much wanted to sort of frame the economy and action on it as the moral equivalent of war. I think he tried to even use self-sacrifice, the dedication, the putting of self-interest second of the troops, and say, isn't that a model for how we ought to deal with
the
economy?
Look how they sacrificed. Look how they dug in. Now let's do it on the economy. Yep.
Yes, I think he was very much looking for that, and I don't know that that's going to affect people. Yes, it was a speech. Isn't it strange? I don't know if these White House, Margaret or David, have some insight, but isn't it strange that this matchless communicator in the set-piece speech, really spellbinder, storyteller.
On the campaign trail.
On the campaign trail. Mm-hmm. Should, in the two Oval Office addresses, the other one was this that really strange one on the Gulf, which got terrible reviews even from his supporters. What goes on when he gets in front of the camera to speak there?
Well, I mean, we're used to presidents not always looking comfortable there. You're in the Oval Office looking at a teleprompter. But Margaret Tullip, what about it? This is a politician who was on the stump, as Jack says, just about matchless at his best.
Well, I hate to return to the old cliche, but I'm going to, obviously. But it is one thing to speak in emotional terms about people's hopes and dreams, and it is another thing to speak in pragmatic terms about what is going to happen and what has to happen. And it's just not romantic. There's no romantic way out of a war, and there is no inspiring way to deal with an economy that is somewhat intractable. And the president's most comfortable venue really grabbing onto people's emotions is a large crowd, a room of, you know, 1,000, a couple thousand, you know, stadium of 5,000 people. He has an incredible energy with a crowd like that, but that is a completely inappropriate venue to talk about stuff like this. But moreover, I think he is constrained by a reality, which is that the November elections, in which the Democrats really need him to be helpful and not unhelpful, appear to hinge so strongly on the economy that is what people are worried about, and that is what people want to talk about. And is there a moral imperative to talk about a war and the end of war? Yes. Is there a reason to do that, to send a message to the rest of the world, to put a marker in the history books? Yes. But is that what's going to turn the election? No. And so even for a very skilled rhetorician, it's a very difficult feat to pull off in one speech.
Let me go to Charlottesville, Virginia, and Gary. Gary, you're on the air.
Hello there.
Hi.
I want to compliment you and your guests. You guys sound very intelligent, on top of the issues and everything. It's wonderful. I have a very good source in Washington, so it was kind of aware of the Glenn Beck rally. And every now and then I watch it every now and then.
Okay.
My thought is that there's a movement to put our heads in the sand because this issue with the economy is so complicated. And your guests have hit around so many issues that seem to be on focus, specifically the one about it needs to be put to the vote, basically. Government focus, government push versus do nothing.
But Gary, we lost you there for a second. Your line's bad. Who's got their head in the sand?
The Glenn Beck movement. It's easier to hide.
The line is rough, but I am very curious about David and Margaret, how you saw that rally last weekend on the Mall in front of the Lincoln Memorial, you know, what it stood for. Gary's critical, says head in the sand there. It was a pretty big turnout. David, how do you interpret what went on there? Is it resonating in Washington, or is it just an event and gone?
You know, I think that it was not meant to resonate in Washington. It was meant to resonate out in the rest of the country. And what I thought was interesting was that Mr. Beck, through his speeches, tried to portray it not as a political rally. Of course, it was one, but almost as a religious revival. You know, there was a lot of references to restoring America back to religious roots, the undertone of which seemed to be to, you know, the Christian roots of the founders and so forth. Many may well interpret that as a message of some intolerance or less than full tolerance for a government that has made it clear, and President Obama has, that his war is against terrorists, not against the Muslim faith.
Mm-hmm.
There are others who would see this as an effort to try to do what happened frequently at other moments in American history, which was try to go back to religious roots as a way to getting to some kind of above politics fundamentalism, American fundamentalism. And I'm not quite sure what he accomplished in the end with that. I suspect that he probably accomplished less than he thought he would, Mr. Beck.
Made a good photo op. It was, of course, the anniversary of Martin Luther King's 1963 I Have a Dream speech made on the...
Left a bad taste in the for a lot of people who believe that he was trying to abrogate some symbolism.
Yes, it did. Indeed. Here's a little bit of Glenn Beck at that rally with his crowd in Washington on the Mall.
We must look inside of ourselves and look at what we truly believe. The Lord will always send a people wake-up calls. And he has been sending us wake-up call after wake-up call after a wake-up call. And it has been through the Republicans and the Democrats. It's all of us. All of us. He has been sending us wake-up calls.
The Lord will send us wake-up calls. Jack, did Glenn Beck give you a wake-up call there?
I have a wake-up call. I watched it, and the religious tone, that really did surprise me. I hadn't followed it enough to know that that was the tack he was taking. And I was struck, yes, the arrogance of appearing where Dr. King did, but also the sort of impious quality to it. I mean, this man said God had effectively told him. He said, I didn't prepare my speech. God inspired me.
Impious as in not pious.
This as in not pious.
TV guy.
A kind of TV approach to it. And I kept thinking, well, what do really religious people, I'm not one, but what do really religious people think about this? Does God just kind of tell Glenn Beck what to say? Is he on those sorts of terms with the Almighty, with omnipotence? He seems to want us to think he is. And, you know, at one level, a man who hears voices is delusional. At another level, someone who claims that kind of connection to the divine would seem to be, it doesn't comport with the old-time religion I was raised on.
Elsewhere, we saw the Tea Party candidate Joe Miller up in Alaska, Sarah Palin territory, knocking out the mainline Republican candidate, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski. He will be on the ballot. Alaska's strongly Republican. He'll likely be in the Senate. Here's Joe Miller talking with reporters on Wednesday.
The thing that's so exciting about this race is that the same type of message is being reflected in other races throughout the United States. It's a message of transferring power from the broken federal government back to the states.
Margaret, what are you hearing from Republicans in Washington? Are they heartened by the Tea Party-leaning victories out on the hustings? Are they worried that it may cause them problems in the general election or sail them in?
Right. Ask them in November. I mean, I don't know how much to read into this because it's Alaska, and I don't think you can look at what happens in Alaska and say, there goes the rest of the country. And I think there were a lot of other factors at play. Sarah Palin's importance, and I don't mean nationally, I mean in Alaska. Another thing to me to look at is that the campaign consultant working with Joe Miller, who's also working with a number of other Tea Party candidates across the country, is a Republican campaign consultant. And there is, a big debate right now about whether the Tea Parties are the Republican Party, whether they are going to amount to the end of the Republican Party, whether they're pushing the Republican Party permanently in another direction. This is just a big soup right now. I don't think we know, and I think we can look for patterns, but there is a danger in feeling too knowing when you step back now and look at the results. Primaries are different than general elections. Alaska is different from, California or Delaware. And we don't know yet. I don't know yet.
Interesting little moment this week when President Obama acknowledged, maybe for the first time or the first time in a long time, the kind of birther stuff that's been swirling around a lot of that crowd, talking about where he was born and his U.S. citizenship and all the rest. Here he is on Sunday with NBC's Brian Williams, who asked the president if he was troubled by the misperceptions out there around him.
I can't spend all my time with my birth certificate plastered on my forehead. It is what the facts are. The facts, and so it's not something that I can, spend all my time worrying about. I don't think the American people want me to spend all my time worrying about it.
David Sanger, the president was just back from vacation for that speech on Tuesday, but he didn't exactly look rested. How are you reading the mood in the White House as it moves into a big, important fall season as summer wraps here?
You know, they've got a tough fall coming. And first of all, nobody expects in the White House that the coming November elections are going to be pretty. The argument is just how bad is it going to look for them. On Afghanistan, they are headed into a big review due in December, but which will play out and probably leak in bits and pieces during the course of the fall, which gets to the question of, is the current strategy likely to work? And from what you see on the ground right now, the results so far are not terribly impressive. The economy is troubled for all of the reasons that we discussed. And so you're in a situation somewhat analogous to where President Clinton was in the first congressional election after he was first elected in 1992, where it looked like a lot was falling apart. And, of course, you'll recall that the Democrats lost big in that election. Now, that said, President Clinton came back and got reelected overwhelmingly. So drawing a straight line from this coming election to the presidential election might be a little risky.
But a lot to read in the president's face there in any case. David Sanger with the New York Times joining us today from Weston, Vermont. David, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Margaret Tolle with McClatchy Newspapers, thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be with you.
And Jack, BP says if it gets too regulated, it won't be able to pay for its meltdown in the Gulf of Mexico. That's rich.
Oh, Rich is right.
Rich is right. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.